Step 1, get ISIS out of Mosul. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The battle for the Iraqi city of Mosul is underway. Some are keeping a close eye on the civilians likely to flee the city.
All the military authorities are agreed on one thing. They will be worried that Islamic State fighters might infiltrate.
Plus, Donald Trump claims the U.S. election is rigged. We ask an expert who's watched elections all over the globe what he makes of that.
I won't say that there's no such thing as fraud in the U.S., but I will certainly say that large-scale fraud on the level that we'd be required to swing a presidential election is not something that keeps me up at night at all.
Also, Abu Dhabi's love affair with falcons.
Some sleep in the same bedroom like the owners. They have their own place in the car.
That's all ahead today here on The World. Good to have you here on this Monday. Let's start today with Iraq. We've heard a lot about how fractured the country is. In fact, things are so polarized that some say Iraq should be broken up into separate countries. Today, though, and perhaps for weeks to come, the marching order is unity. Five disparate fighting forces with the same goal, getting ISIS out of Iraq's second-largest city, Mosul, with the end game, getting rid of ISIS for good. Along the way, though, the toll on civilians could be massive. And what happens when ISIS flees Mosul is another problem. The World's Richard Hall is in Beirut, keeping track of the assault.
So right now we have about 30,000 soldiers altogether surrounding Mosul. The offensive to recapture the city has started. It started in the earlier hours of this morning. At the moment we have Kurdish forces leading the fight. They are recapturing villages to the east on the outskirts of Mosul. And during this first phase, the aim is to cut off any escape routes for Islamic State fighters who may be fleeing west into Syria. And then later, more forces from the Iraqi army and other forces joining the campaign will join in.
So who else is helping out with this? You've mentioned the Kurdish forces, the Iraqi army. There's more than that, right?
Yeah, it's kind of an unholy alliance in many ways. You have the Iraqi army, you have Kurdish forces. You also have U.S. soldiers on the ground supporting airstrikes. And you also have Shia militias from further south in Iraq. And to add to that, you also have Turkish soldiers in the region who are insisting they want to play a role in the fight as well.
Right. So that's 30,000 troops right there. Who's coordinating all this? It sounds like it could create some traffic jams.
That's right. So the Iraqi army is supposed to be leading the fight, but it really is a joint fight between all these forces. It's kind of a remarkable feat that all these forces, who aren't necessarily friends, I mean, they have really serious disagreements with each other, but it's kind of a testament to the brutality of ISIS that all these forces have come together to fight ISIS. But led by the Iraqi army, with Kurdish fighters taking a kind of secondary role and the U.S. kind of coordinating airstrikes and air support.
Yeah, tell us more about the U.S. role here. I know they've added another 600 troops for the assault on Mosul. That's a total of 5,200, though, in Iraq. What are all these troops doing?
Yeah, so this is it's been described as the biggest U.S. operation in Iraq since the withdrawal, maybe even since the Iraq War, midway into the Iraq War. It really is a huge, huge operation for the U.S., for the U.S. Army. They are on the ground. They are advising. They are directing airstrikes. So they really are involved on the ground in a meaningful way. And in the run-up to this offensive, they've, of course, been advising and training these various forces in how to retake Mosul.
Now, despite the civilians who've already fled Mosul, there are still about 1 million residents there. The assaulting forces have told them to stay inside. But how are they going to survive this?
This is one of the major challenges of this operation. How do you protect the civilians that have stayed behind in Mosul? Now, the Iraqi government has said that they are creating exit points for civilians to leave. But aid agencies have said these exit points aren't clear. And there was a big risk that they get caught up in the fighting, whether it's by snipers or booby traps or explosives, landmines, airstrikes. It could be anything. So there was really a huge, huge risk for civilians here. And then the risk doesn't end when they leave Mosul. The aid agencies have been preparing for this offensive for a long time, but many are saying they're still not ready. They are expecting around 200,000 people to leave the city in the first weeks of the offensive. They have around 60,000 tents ready for people to leave. So there is a huge gap between what they've prepared for and the amount they're expecting to come out. And these are people that are going to need food and water. Mm. And so they could be in a desperate situation.
So what do you think this assault on Mosul is going to look like in the days ahead, Rich? A simple capture or a prolonged fight that could last weeks, even months?
I think we're probably looking at around at least weeks. The commander of the U.S.-led coalition in the country, Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, said it could take weeks, maybe longer. There's no doubt that this coalition will emerge victorious, but it's going to be a difficult fight. And again, the problem is what comes after that. How do you avoid making the same mistakes that allowed ISIS to flourish in Mosul in the first place and allowed them to take over in the first place? How do you rehabilitate Mosul, which is kind of a microcosm for the rise of ISIS in the first place? So how do you solve those problems?
The world's Richard Hall in Beirut. Richard mentioned the threat to civilians in the push to retake Mosul. One aid group working in the region is a British nonprofit called Shelter Box. Rachel Harvey is one of their emergency responders. She's in the Iraqi city of Erbil. That's only about an hour from Mosul by road. But Harvey says aid groups are not sure what to expect.
I wish I could be precise, Marco. If we knew all the answers, we'd be able to make a much better plan. The truth is, we have to react to what happens on the ground, and that is dictated in part by the military operation and in part by how people within Mosul City themselves react to what's happening. We have been told that the Iraqi security forces were dropping leaflets ahead of this operation, telling civilians in Mosul City to remain indoors, to stay inside, lock their doors, and to try and stay safe. Our anticipation is that that will be for the time that the airstrikes continue. In this initial phase of the military operation, it's simply not safe for people to come outside and try to escape. Add to that the fact that we know Islamic State are going to try and prevent civilians from leaving. We don't know then at what stage people are going to be able to leave the city. But as the military pushes up towards the city itself on the ground, they are clearing villages and other territory that's held by Islamic State. So people have already begun to flee from those areas to safety, some of them further south into Iraq, some of them coming into Iraqi Kurdistan here.
So your nonprofit is called Shelterbox. What does Shelterbox do? What will Shelterbox be doing in this situation?
We specialize in emergency shelter. So in this response, we have some aid that is already pre-positioned. So some emergency aid, things like blankets, water carriers, solar lamps, and tarpaulins and fixings. So a basic emergency shelter kit with some extra life-saving aid items. What the next phase will be is that we have our family emergency tents coming into country. We hope that the first lot will be arriving on Tuesday. The aim will be to pre-position those in places where we hope we will then be able to react really quickly when people start coming into this region and needing our help.
How do you figure that out? Because you don't want to get too close to Mosul. Otherwise, you're putting up a camp in the middle of a war zone. On the other hand, you don't want all those people walking all the way to Erbil either, do you?
That's absolutely true. We will be in the places where the military have declared that we are beyond the front lines and in places where it's safe to set up those kind of emergency shelter settlements. The way this is going to work, in effect, is that in Kurdish areas, the Peshmerga military will screen people that are leaving just to make sure who's there and to register them, and then they will be moved into emergency settlements, some into formal UN-run camps, but those are going to fill up really quickly. There simply isn't enough capacity. So there will then be other more informal camps, emergency camps, and that's probably where Shelterbox will be working.
Yeah, so planning amid insecurity and uncertainty. How worried are people about the danger of infiltration and attack during all this humanitarian assistance?
All the military authorities are agreed on one thing, whether it's the militias involved in this, whether it's the Iraqi security forces, whether it's Peshmerga, whether it's the other coalition forces, including the United States, they will be worried that Islamic State fighters might infiltrate. That is always a worry, but that's precisely where they're going to be doing the screening. As humanitarians, we can't make that kind of distinction. Anybody that turns up needing help, we will try and do our best to help them and rely on the military to screen out those who they would see as problems.
Rachel Harvey with the aid group Shelterbox speaking with us from northern Iraq. Thank you very much, Rachel.
You're very welcome.
Yesterday, a family reunion that many never thought would happen. 21 Nigerian schoolgirls who had been held by the extremists of Boko Haram, the girls rushed into the arms of their waiting families. They'd been in captivity for more than 2 years after being abducted from their boarding school in the northeastern town of Chibok in 2014. 21 girls back with their families, but some 200 of the kidnapped girls are still missing, and it's believed that some of them are still alive. Their plight received international attention with the social media campaign, Bring Back Our Girls. Nigerian author and journalist Adobe Trishan Obani has been following their saga. She says, no surprise, the reunion between the girls and their families yesterday was joyous.
As you can imagine, the parents were ecstatic. They were in tears. A mother carried her daughter on her back and held her, wrapped around her back for most of the ceremony. There was a girl with her baby, a girl called Deborah Jafara. I had met her parents in Chibok sometime last year, and they had said their daughter had got married 2 weeks before she was abducted. And so the baby she was carrying, her father said, was actually a pregnancy from that marriage. And the baby was born in the forest. So there was the reunion with the grandchild, the girl's father hugging his grandchild.
It sounds pretty dramatic, but I said there were also 200 other girls who had been kidnapped and they're still missing. And yet some of their families were invited to these reunion ceremonies and were bussed in. That must have been pretty difficult for them.
Exactly. Parents said to me that it was when they got to the ceremony and watched the other parents rejoicing with their daughters that it dawned on them that they weren't going to be reunited with their daughters. So one of the mothers, for example, Yana Galang, the women leader, she stood in a corner and was crying.
Oh.
But the good news is that these parents were able to confirm from their conversations with the girls, at least what they told me. They said the girls told them that their daughters were alive in the batch of 83, still left with a faction of Boko Haram that released these girls, the ISIS-led faction that released these girls. They've released 21. Government of, a spokesperson told me yesterday that 20 of the girls were for the government. They were supposed to be tailbearers to let the government know that they were serious about the negotiations, and then they could come back for the 83 girls whose names they provided to the government to say we have them and we're serious about negotiations. The 21st girl, they had said, was a donation to a certain man called Zana Mustafa, who initiated the negotiation. This man is apparently a trusted figure amongst the Boko Haram because they do have people they trust. They've had journalists that they speak with regularly. They have women that they talk to. You know, there's certain figures that are known in Nigeria as being, in quote, friends of Boko Haram.
So why were the girls let go now? And why only 21 of them? What's in it for Boko Haram with this deal?
We don't know exactly what's going on. They've said these 20 girls are tailbearers. Then it means that there is something they want, and they've given us 21 to taste what it's like to have some of the girls back and, of course, whet the appetite of the parents. And they were very careful because I noticed that none of the girls who were released are girls whose parents have been in the media. So they are being very careful to make sure that the very outspoken parents don't have their daughters released yet.
I mean, there's suggestion that they were paid a ransom for these girls and that maybe even some Boko Haram fighters in captivity may be released. Have you heard that?
I've heard the rumor about the money paid. The government has definitely denied having exchanged anyone, but they haven't denied having paid any money.
What about the mental health of these girls now and kind of getting reintegrated into the society that they left when they were kidnapped 2 years ago? How hard is that going to be?
I think it's going to be something that the government is going to struggle with a little bit, especially considering the fact that Amina Ali, the one Chibok girl who was found in May, is still not reunited with her parents. She still hasn't reintegrated into society. She's still under lock and key. The government has her in a safe house. Almost 5 months after she was found, she still hasn't gone back to normal life. So I think it's going to be a little bit of a struggle. But then I'm sure that now that we have more girls, not just one girl, the government is probably going to reach out for more help. And it's something some of us are very concerned about and we'll keep watching out for over the next few weeks and months.
Thank you very much, as always.
Thank you, Marco.
Nigerian author and journalist Adobe Trisha Nobani. You're listening to The World. For this next story, I have our own Shirin Jafari in the studio with me, and I know why you're here, Shirin. You've got something pretty special you're going to share with us.
That's right, Marco. Quick question for you. What is the national bird of the United States?
All right, that's pretty simple. It's the bald eagle. Also happens to be the only eagle native to just North America. Just throwing that out there, too.
Okay. But the reason I'm here today is not to test you on the eagle, but to tell you about another very important national bird. I just came back from a reporting trip to the United Arab Emirates, or the UAE. It's a country right along the Persian Gulf, actually not far from where I come from, Iran. And can you guess what their national bird is?
Yeah, I'm seeing a man with a leather glove, and on that glove is a falcon.
You got it right.
Two for two.
And so I found out, Marco, that the falcon plays a big, big part in Emirati culture. You can see that from the moment you get to the airport. They're everywhere. You can see them on the walls. They're even in the ads. They play on the TV.
Pictures of them, not the real thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're even on the national currency, the dirham. I also found out that there's even a hospital in the UAE just for falcons.
Incredible.
And of course, I had to check it out. To get to the hospital, you have to drive down a long, dusty road between Abu Dhabi and Dubai, also known as the middle of nowhere. But don't be fooled by its remote location. This is the largest hospital in the world that specializes in falcons. Only falcons. The waiting room is packed with Emirati men in their traditional white garb and headpieces. Their bears are proudly perched on their arms. Some of them flap their wings as the owners move them about. The bears have tight leather hoods on their heads. It's to keep them calm in a distracting environment like this one. I wait awkwardly among the sea of men and their bears. The guys are staring at me and my microphone. Thankfully, though, the wait doesn't last too long.
My name is Dr. Margit Gabrielle Muller. I'm the director of the Abu Dhabi Falcon Hospital.
Muller runs the show here. She eats, sleeps, and breathes falcons. Okay, she doesn't eat falcons, but you know. There's falcon-themed stationery on our desk. Falcon feathers, falcons carved out of wood, you name it.
I think I was the first who did a PhD in falcons in Germany.
And it turns out this German veterinarian with a PhD in falcons was the exact person the Abu Dhabi hospital was looking for back in 2001. Muller got an invitation to come to the UAE and head the place. She said yes. But why, you might ask, did Abu Dhabi need a falcon hospital? Simply because this city was and is still today the epicenter of falconry.
Here in Abu Dhabi and the Middle East, falconry has always been a necessity for the Bedouins to survive in the desert because the falcons were hunting meat to let the Bedouins' families survive in these very difficult, harsh times. So the falcon was never regarded as a sports tool. The falcon has been integrated in the Bedouins' family like a child, like a son or daughter.
Yeah, she's not kidding about that son or daughter thing.
They live with them in the living room. Some sleep in the same bedroom like the owners. They have their own place in the car.
And their own hospital, where they can get the state-of-the-art medical care.
Hello, good.
Hi, doctor.
Muller shows me to the examination room, where I get to see Dr. Mohammed Nazir and his assistant in action. A motionless falcon lies on the operating table. An oxygen mask covers her tiny head. She's under anesthesia.
Yes, she's going to wake up, actually.
She's having her nails trimmed and polished, which I'm told is a routine and key part of falcon care. Once the talons are done, it's time to work on the beak.
So you do the same for the beak?
Yeah, same like talons. We have to cut the beak also as well.
How many times a year do you do that?
Same like talons, 2 to 3 times in a year, both.
And a couple of minutes later...
Did it just wake up?
Yes.
Hello,
she not still moves.
I just had a pedicure and manicure.
Yes.
Another falcon gets a GPS microchip implanted in its chest.
Can I get a flu, please?
Of course, there are much more complicated procedures than the ones I got to see, like the case of the falcon that was run over by a car.
When the falcon came to us, it was already lying down in shock. It looked horrible. On the head, you just had the rubber of the car tire and all the skin, everything was gone. And all my team said when they saw her that it's finished. I mean, this falcon can never survive. The falcon was lying on the floor. She lifted her head up. She looked, she focused in my eyes like she wanted to give me the message. And she said, you know, try, please. Don't let me die.
And try, Muller did. A couple of surgeries later, 3 days of intensive care, and the falcon survived.
Oh, she gave me a lot of gray hair, this falcon.
That passion right there, I saw it in so many of the people I met at the hospital. Like Fahed El-Badi. El-Badi grew up hunting with falcons. He's full of stories about going to the desert with his brother and cousins.
What is your relationship like with your falcon?
Actually, the falcon, we are dealing with him like the member of our family. Sometimes we care more than we are care about other person.
El-Badi doesn't have a son of his own yet, but he says if and when he does, he wants to pass his beloved falcon on to him, just like many do here. And as both El-Badi and Muller tell me, this is what it's all about, keeping a tradition alive.
You need always to remember the United Arab Emirates are a very young country. So it means that the Bedouins have been thrown from a very basic desert lifestyle into a very modern high-tech life in such a short time. So it means it is essential for them to preserve their heritage, their tradition. If they do not have their roots, and falconry is one of the big, big connections to their past, to their roots, they will lose their own identity.
For 15 years, Muller has been making sure that doesn't happen. Not an easy job for a woman here.
The first year was very difficult. Nowadays, we have a very strong relationship, me and my falconers, and they have elevated me now to a half man. I can't become a full man, of course, but it's a big compliment here.
Over the years, Muller and her team have discovered two new diseases in falcons. They've set up a rehab center as well as an educational program for the kids. And I've done all that, making sure the birds go out into the world, sporting perfectly manicured nails. For the world, Shirin Jafari, United Arab Emirates.
Surgery on a falcon. You've got to see the stunning behind-the-scenes photos of that and more at PRI.org. These days in the UAE, falconry is mostly about hunting and sport. Competitions for falcon speed and agility, that kind of thing. Here's music from Estonia about a different kind of animal competition. The song is called Hobusmang, or the Horse Game. It's arranged and performed by violinist Maria Nut. The horse game goes way back in Estonia. Children would play a singing game where they would sing progressive verses about, first, a lost horse, then a verse about the wolf that would find the horse, then break its neck, then another verse that would invoke another animal to deal with the wolf, and so on. Anyway, yeah, PG-13 to say the least. Here's more from Maria Nut. You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the publisher of the Arizona Republic talks about the backlash of the newspaper's presidential endorsement and why it makes her think about her mother's family in Korea.
They didn't have a free press. They didn't have a democracy. They did not have freedom of religion. It makes you realize how precious what we have is.
That story coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Heartbreaking is the word used by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to describe the town of Lekai in southwest Haiti. Ban's remarks came after he saw firsthand this weekend the devastation wrought by Hurricane Matthew. He also expressed concerns that the international community wasn't doing enough to help. Many Haitians are still waiting for food, shelter, and medicine, and cholera is threatening to become a big problem. From a town just to the west of Lekai, Amy Bracken has our story.
If you Google images of Port-Salut, Haiti, you'll see a Caribbean paradise. White sand beaches, coconut trees, inviting turquoise sea. The hotel Reposoir de Village had a bar on the beach and tables under thatch umbrellas. When I stayed there 2 years ago, the only problem was an almond tree noisily dropping its fruit on the tin roof. Today, it's silent. There's no more tin roof, and the almond tree has lost its branches. The bar and restaurant are now just a mess of downed trees and rubble. Only a cement hut office is still standing. It's where I find Chelo Lamé clearing debris.
Bon, la pluie avec vent commence à tomber, m'ti la came.
When the wind and rain came, I was at home, he says. A piece of tin from my roof fell on my head, but it didn't injure me. I was with one of my children, and early in the morning I ran with my child under my arm, and we finally got to a cement house. Thank God my children weren't hurt, he says. But a young relative of his, a baby girl, Anaika, was killed when a piece of tin roof hit her head. Now LeMay and 11 others are sleeping in one room together, the same place he had fled to in the storm. Outside the hut, a cauldron of fish soup simmers over a charcoal fire. LeMay lost his full-time job as a cook, but now he's earning a bit of money making meals for the workers hired to clear the land. He says he and other former workers around here are focused on finding jobs to support their children. And rebuilding, he says, well, that won't be easy. It will take a long time and will require a lot of money, a lot of aid, a lot of thinking through, and a lot of patience. I ask LeMay and the laborers he's cooking for if they know a distribution is going on in town right now. The aid group Samaritan's Purse is giving out blankets, plastic sheeting for roofs, rain collection buckets, and soap. Yes, they say, but they couldn't go because they're working. And besides, there's never enough, and the police get aggressive with the crowds. Later, at the distribution site, I ask a group of women carrying away supplies if the aid was what they had needed. Clearly, it helps, but is not enough. They say their neighborhood, called Sipion, has been destroyed, and nobody has been by to see them. So we head over. Where a river crosses the road, we leave the car and cross on foot. The knee-high water is clear sapphire, and it looks delicious under this relentless, dehydrating sun. Locals say they've been told the river might be contaminated after Matthew, but they don't have other options for drinking water. At what's left of the first house in Sipion, we speak with Anderson Darius. If cholera comes here, as it's come to other places, Darius says, a lot of people will die here because we don't have clean drinking water. There has already been an uptick in cholera cases in other parts of southwest Haiti since the hurricane. And Darius says the local well is damaged and the price in town for small sacks of water has gone up in the last week. Imagine that for the moment you have a bit of money reserved and a little plantain tree, he says. The tree fell and you cut it. You can survive for 2 or 3 weeks, but after 15 or 22 days, you won't have anything left. So aid would help us a lot. People eat, he goes on, but you don't eat to fill your stomach. You eat just enough to keep going. I wish for help to come as quickly as possible, because if you wait 15 or 22 days, people might not survive. 6 people were in this house in the storm when the roof blew off. Like LeMay, they all fled to a cement-roofed house and are still sleeping there every night. One of them is an elderly woman named Enid Saint-Jour. I ask her what went through her head when the storm was over. She slaps her hands against each other in a sign of resignation and says, I don't have anything. House, I have no house. I don't have any house. I don't have any garden at all. All my animals died. Goats, sheep, pigs, all died. Some of the women I first met on the road are waiting for us out front. And soon they are taking me by the arm, pulling me in one direction or another to see destroyed house after destroyed house. Most homes along the road are completely uninhabitable. Just a Cadiz home is mostly rubble. I was standing here with the children like this, she says, pressing herself against one of the remaining inside walls. The wind was blowing, and then the whole roof blew away as we were standing here. I kept calling out for the children, and they'd say, we're here. I was convinced they would die, and I knew I would die here, too. But they made it safely to the neighbor's house, the one house around with a cement roof. She, along with most of the neighborhood, sleeps there these days. The mayor of Port-Salut has reported that dozens in his town died in the storm. I asked Kadi if any of the deaths were here in Sipion. No, she says. We were lucky. For the World, Amy Bracken, Port-Salut, Haiti.
The Republican candidate is now stating unequivocally that the U.S. election is rigged. The election is absolutely being rigged by the dishonest and distorted media pushing crooked Hillary, Trump announced yesterday on Twitter. This is not the first time Trump has made claims about the U.S. election being rigged. His message on Sunday was met with plenty of skepticism, including from officials in his own party. But it got us wondering, what does a rigged election actually look like? And how do you do it? Daniel Murphy's got a pretty good idea. He's an electoral expert with Democracy International. That's an organization that monitors elections around the globe. Thanks for being with us, Dan. You're familiar with many countries where elections do not happen fairly, where you might say things are rigged. What does that typically look like?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. I'm pleased to be with you today. I think that, you know, one of the things about elections is it's an exercise in public trust. And so if you see one candidate start talking about the election being rigged, that in and of itself is a problem. But in order to answer your question, I mean, there are a number of ways to sort of rig an election. The most traditional ones would typically be ballot stuffing, where you see just, you know, poll workers stuffing ballots or individuals from the community stuffing ballots, that sort of thing, where you actually just put in ballots that are not valid. You see misrecording of votes. Sometimes they don't go through the process of stuffing the ballots. They just put, you know, whatever they want to see on the results form, that sort of thing. And then you also see something like intimidation, where anybody who disagrees with the political party that might be in power or might be trying to influence the election in a certain way is not allowed to speak, or civil society groups. We saw that in Egypt 14, where, you know, we didn't see any ballot stuffing, that sort of thing. But we certainly saw a political climate that didn't allow free expression of ideas prior to the election.
So you mentioned Egypt. These tactics happen regularly in what other countries? Like, who's on your wall of shame?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, personally, I was in Afghanistan in 2009. I was a fraud investigator for the Electoral Complaints Commission, and we saw a lot of ballot stuffing. We saw a lot of things that were sort of easier to catch. Like, for instance, every single polling place in Afghanistan in 2009 had 600 ballots. So it was a pretty easy thing to know that you needed to look more closely at a polling station that recorded results of 750 votes for a certain candidate, that kind of thing. I was in Kosovo in 2010, and what we actually saw was a lot of ballot stuffing there, but there was also a sort of more background kind of fraud where employees of the Count and Results Center were paid off to manipulate the data after the ballots were cast.
I mean, it strikes me that the ultimate rigged election is one where there's only a single candidate and the choice is between yes and no. I have literally seen a ballot like that. That is obviously not the case here in the U.S. Trump's statement, though, is that the media has rigged the election because I guess he believes the media are against him. What is the role of the media, though, in some of the countries you've been talking about?
Egypt is the classic example where the media was definitely in the pocket of the, you know, the ruling party, or at that point, not a ruling party, but the sort of the team that was on the winning side. And there was no ability of anyone who disagreed with Sisi and or his message to have any fair platform. I think that it's hard for Trump to say that he doesn't have a platform. I think the media absolutely has given him the opportunity to speak. And I think that now that things are coming out that he doesn't like as much, he's saying that the media is rigging things. During the Republican, you know, presidential primary, I don't think he was saying that the media was rigging things when they were giving him lots and lots of airtime.
So what are the safeguards here in the U.S. to ensure free and fair elections?
Well, I think that the U.S. I won't say that the U.S. system doesn't need, you know, some reform and that there aren't things we can improve upon. But one of the number one things about the U.S. system that protects us against large-scale fraud is the huge number of government entities that are actually responsible for administering the election. So, you know, when you look at that, the idea of large-scale rigging on a technical level in the U.S., it would be exceedingly complicated to do that, and you would have to have a very large conspiracy to be able to pull that off.
Still, I mean, we're talking about some precincts around the U.S. that are dealing with inadequate space for voters. There's redistricting, of course, that's blocking some voters from actually voting. And there are new laws in various places around the country that actually block access to early voting. So as someone who's studied rigged elections around the globe, how concerned are you with the legitimacy of the U.S. elections?
I won't say that there's no such thing as fraud in the U.S., but I will certainly say that large-scale fraud on the level that we'd be required to swing a presidential election is not something that keeps me up at night at all.
Daniel Murphy, Director of Elections and Political Processes at Democracy International. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Outrage. That's been one of the defining words of this exhausting presidential campaign. Just ask Mia Parrish. She's the head of the Arizona Republic newspaper, which recently endorsed Hillary Clinton for president. That was the first time in the paper's 126-year history that it's endorsed a Democrat. And the backlash has been intense. Mia Parrish and her staff have been receiving numerous threats like, "You're dead, watch your back, we will burn you down, you should be put in front of the firing squad as a traitor." Mia Parrish joins me now. How did threats like that actually make you feel, Mia?
It's been a remarkable time in every way. Our reporters are just doing their jobs, and to have something that the editorial board, which is separate from the newsroom, express an opinion about, come crashing down on them in such an intense and evil way, has been chilling.
Do you know who the people are who are making these threats? Have there been any consequences for them?
No, the death threats that you were talking about, and there have been some others, those have come through anonymously, either in email or in calls, and we've attempted to track them down and have not been able to.
We usually hear people receiving threats like this, and journalists, for endorsing one candidate over another, not here in the U.S. What do you feel like that says about the state of our country right now?
I was really saddened. I mean, truthfully, we also had telegraphed for more than a year about our concerns around Donald Trump and his policies long before he was the nominee of the party, and felt that he was not good for Arizona and he wasn't good for the United States. And I felt strongly that we needed to stand up. We want people to vote. We want people to engage. We want to empower and enlighten. And for us individually as citizens, we didn't want to have the option not to vote, and we weren't going to sit down as a news organization and just take a pass. So we didn't.
Now, you wrote that one person you thought about when making the decision at the paper to endorse Hillary Clinton, you were thinking about your mother, who grew up under an occupying dictatorship. Tell us about her. Where did she grow up, and what made you think of her?
My mother grew up in South Korea. She immigrated in 1954 through the help of the kindness of Americans. She and her sisters were all educated in the United States, as was their brother. And I grew up with their stories. They sacrificed tremendously. They didn't have a right to an education. They didn't have a free press. They didn't have a democracy. You know, everything that I hold dear in the First Amendment. And that's probably why, to grow up hearing that, to be on death lists, to have your grandfather imprisoned and nearly tortured to death for his religious beliefs, it makes you realize how precious what we have is.
And I want to ask this, too. I mean, in a state like Arizona, where you can carry a weapon openly or concealed without a permit, how does that deepen your worry?
We've really tried. I take things seriously, and it's my responsibility to look out for all of us and to make good decisions for that. But I also don't want to be alarmist about it. We have additional security, and we have conveyed to the staff about the importance of being mindful. I think the thing that made me more upset were, it's one thing to protect the building and to staff up security guards and to make sure that people are watched and walked and there's tape and all of that. But we have hundreds and hundreds of people out in the community who do things like knock door to door selling subscriptions, and who stand in grocery stores selling subscriptions. Right. And those are kids working their way through school. And they've been threatened, they've been spit on, they've been called terrible, terrible names. And they're fearful. And that is, to me, a tragedy, that to engage in a free press and to have someone who disagrees with something that someone else said so much, you would threaten their lives. We got threats again this morning about that, that have been reported to police.
So you've written this editorial, Mia. What do you have to say, though, to the people, like directly, who have been making these threats to you and your staff?
We are strong and they are brave, and I will stand up for their right to disagree with me every day. It is never acceptable to threaten someone with violence because they disagree with you. That is un-American.
Mia Parrish with the Arizona Republic, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco. I appreciate it.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Donald Trump has claimed the election is rigged. He's bragged about groping and kissing women. He's called for drug tests for the candidates ahead of Wednesday's debate. And that's just in the past week or so. Are any of Trump's claims damaging his campaign here in the U.S.? Well, depends whom you ask. But we wondered if any of this negative publicity was affecting the Trump brand globally. We're going to turn to The World's Will Carlos in Rio de Janeiro for some insight on this. So you've been speaking with one of Brazil's top Trump campaign supporters, someone who says he's a friend, admirer, and a business partner of Donald Trump's. Is any of the negative publicity surrounding Trump impacting his business or his ability to sell the Trump brand in Brazil.
Yeah, so I sat down last week with Paulo Figueiredo Filho. He's, as you say, a businessman here, a loyal Trump supporter. He's also happens to be the grandson of the last dictatorship era president in Brazil. And I put that question to him, and here's what he had to say.
A lot of Brazilians will think of him as a crazy person, as a person that don't like immigrants, don't like Muslims, sometimes makes crazy comments about women or and all that. But on the other side, a lot of Brazilians do perceive him as a very successful businessman, as a self-made man, to be well in life, to a life, actually to a lifestyle.
Yeah, so did you ask Mr. Figueiredo about the accusations that women are making about Donald Trump right now?
I did. And just to give this a little bit of context, this guy is an investor in the new Trump Hotel here in town in Rio de Janeiro, which is actually a couple of blocks from my house. And he did stress that he's got nothing to do. He doesn't want to speak on behalf of the investors. But yeah, I put that question to him, you know, does he worry that this sort of these negative comments, this negative image surrounding women could be troubling? And here's what he said.
The type of conversation he had, private conversation, we have to point that. It's not, was not a public statement. It's very common in Brazil, and it's the type of conversation that most men have in a locker room. We're very used to that. It's part of the culture. He almost sounded like a Brazilian.
What about Brazilian women? Do you think those comments will have upset Brazilian women and maybe even have turned some Brazilian women off the Trump brand?
Brazilian women, of course, they don't like to be disrespected, but they're used to the Brazilian men's culture, and they know that men talk like this when they're together, and as long as they're respectful and in their public statements, they can do whatever they want in their private life. So I don't think most women, I don't think this was a big issue in Brazil at all.
Wow. What do Brazilian women have to say about that, Will?
Well, I think as far as the first part of what he's saying about, you know, the culture, the sort of macho culture in Brazil and the way that Brazilian men talk, there's certainly a large amount of truth to that. I mean, I hear comments like, you know, kind of similar to this fairly frequently. You know, you see women getting harassed on the street and that sort of thing. But as far as, you know, all Brazilian women kind of accepting this and saying, hey, that's just how we do things here. Look, I mean, I've spoken to lots of activists here, lots of smart young Brazilian women who just are sick of that idea. You know, they're upset with this idea that things should just continue as normal and very much reject that as kind of the status quo going forwards and are kind of battling against that. And we're seeing an increase in the feminist movement here, an increasing number of women undoubtedly who kind of say, look, enough is enough and we need to actually get away from that stereotype.
So I'm curious, Will, is the kind of anti-politician populism that we've seen in the U.S. election since the primaries, is that also going on in Brazil where local elections are actually underway?
Yes, it is. And most notably, the incoming mayor of São Paulo, a guy called João Doria, ran on a very sort of Trumpian ticket. He ran as an outsider, as a businessman, not a politician. He's actually the former host of The Apprentice in Brazil. And he's kind of the most high-profile version of what's going on across Brazil, where people are so fed up of politicians and kind of the mindset and the corruption and everything else that they're increasingly looking to these kind of populist candidates. We've seen that all across Brazil in the last couple of weeks.
The World's Will Carlos in Rio de Janeiro. Thanks very much, Will.
Thank you.
And finally today, that's the sound of an evangelical Lutheran church in Helsinki, Finland. Every day at 5 p.m. local time, the church has been ringing its funeral bells. The idea is to draw attention to the suffering of people in the besieged city of Aleppo in Syria. Today, 200 more churches across Finland joined in. Teemu Laa Jasalo is vicar of Kallio Parish in Helsinki, where the movement to pay tribute actually started. Why did you decide to do this?
Well, thank you for having me. I think it's quite clear. The situation in Syria and in Aleppo is politically complex, but morally really simple. Killing children and civilians is wrong. And, you know, schools and hospitals are being bombed and little children are being killed. So something has to be done. That's the idea.
Right. So tolling the bells and making people aware of why you're tolling. How many churches are now participating in this?
You know, we started with one church, and I think in 2 or 3 days, there are now over 300 churches with us. Churches from four continents, from Finland, from Sweden, Estonia, France, UK, Germany, Hungary, even in Australia, South Africa, and so on. So it's really amazing.
So were you at your church when the bell started ringing today, and what was that like?
Well, you know, they are funeral bells, and funeral bells are tolled normally when the body is carried out of the church after the service. You know, somehow you can feel the symbolic meaning. In Aleppo, there is non-stop funeral, and it's really, I don't know, hard to take that.
What about any Syrian refugees in Finland? Have they been reacting to the bells?
We have had quite many contacts also from Syrians, and of course they have been thankful and they have been praying with us. But there are not so many, especially Syrian refugees in Finland, just couple of hundreds.
And the refugees who are there, are they warming up to this idea?
Yeah, they are mainly from Iraq and Somalia.
So what happens with the ringing of the bells after this week?
Well, we hope that people are reading Bible and listen to words of Christ, that blessed are the peacemakers, and this is the main message here.
And for those who are not God-fearing, do you hope the bells at least inspire them a little bit?
Well, I think that even you're not Christian, you can say that blessed are the peacemakers. Isn't it so?
Teemu Laajasalo is the vicar of Kallio Parish in Helsinki. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.